poppin', everybody. Hello and welcome to episode 1 of Popcorn Culture. My name is Ben Carlin and I am your host. Here with me today is my brother Jay, who will be in every episode.
Pretty sure that just makes us co-hosts?
I think it makes you a co-host.
Whatever you say there, other host.
Yeah, that was a zinger.
Yeah.
You totally got me.
You're right. We will figure out the hosting business at some point. I have some ideas about that.
Sure.
Ben, I believe if anyone listened to episode 0, this is episode 1, not to be confused with episode 0, which already came out.
Which is the first episode.
Yeah. So this is Merry Christmas, everyone, by the way.
Yeah,
this is
no
coming
kidding.
Out on Christmas.
This is the very first episode coming out on Christmas Day. What a thing. How about that?
Yeah. Hope everyone's doing good. Ben, did you want to, I feel like last time we talked about opening with a corny joke.
I do have a corny joke.
Let me hear it.
Jay, why was the sand wet?
I don't know, Ben. Why was the sand wet?
Because the seaweed. It weed?
Oh, the seaweed. I get it. I was like, wait a second. I was trying to think it was weeing crying. And I was like, the sea doesn't weed. Is it a word for cry?
No, it's seaweed.
Like the sea wad or something.
The sea wad.
Okay.
Oh, man.
Oh, I got it.
Okay, so to launch off episode 1 here, there's sort of a fascinating phenomenon that we get to benefit from, and that is that we have had episode 0.
Yeah.
Which means we can kick off by responding to feedback.
This is why I think episode 0 is necessary for podcasts, because a lot of the podcasts I listen to, I feel like a big portion of it is feedback, and you can't have feedback if you don't have something there.
Right. No, right. I think when it really comes down to it, podcasters in general are all lazy, inherently, and therefore they're using the feedback as like inspiration, because clearly anything anybody said in response to what you previously said is them adding to a conversation you've already had, which just means we can continue that conversation.
It's going to be great. So
even further.
What feedback from our last episode stood out to you? Let me hear it.
Okay, so there was a lot of like different things that sort of people had reached out to me about that I thought were really interesting. But what has almost become our tagline, at least as far as episode 1 is concerned, is you said in episode 0, we have strong opinions about things that don't matter.
Oh, strong opinions about weak things.
Yeah. Exactly. And sort of your reasoning for this particular viewpoint on the world is sort of that, like, you do have strong opinions about things that do matter, but those are like dicier things to have conversations about. So instead, you have really strong opinions about things that don't matter, because then it's like, if you really, really, really don't like Moe's, you know, the fast food eatery, it's like, that doesn't matter in the scheme of things.
I feel like you're trying to wind me up.
I can see steam coming out of your ears visibly right now.
Here's the thing. The way I often view it is that when you have, it's fun to have strong opinions about weak things, because you can sort of argue them really vehemently without really hurting anyone's feelings.
Sure.
You know, more or less. Sometimes people don't know what you're doing and they think you're being really offended by the most minute things, and it could totally backfire. But the thing about having strong opinions about strong things is that I just very often don't feel like I am personally well-informed enough about a thing.
Absolutely.
Like, I don't want to like say something that I just haven't had the time to investigate, or someone hasn't like pointed out a point of view. So I just like to like really discuss a lot of things, because if you haven't really thought through something or discussed a lot of like a stronger thing about like a particular like opinion on politics or something, then often you can just seem really ignorant to someone who is very well educated on the thing. And I don't know, maybe that's a good opportunity to learn. But in the meantime, we're just going to have lots of strong opinions about weak things.
There you go. Strong opinions about weak things. So one of the things that sort of happens is that with what we do, so as internet creators that make content specifically around fandoms, you know, talking about Disney and Pixar and Star Wars and Harry Potter and Marvel and all that stuff, whenever a new movie comes out or a trailer drops or, you know, any piece of new information, frequently our fan base wants to know sort of like, what did you think? Like, what were your thoughts? And like, they're maybe even leaning on us to help direct their strong opinions about things that don't matter. And I find that frequently we will be presenting our opinions on something and then become so far detached from them that, for one, we completely forgot what our opinions were, because it has been such a long period of time. And that very phenomenon happened in episode 0, where you and I were talking about the Cars movies from Pixar.
Right.
And we were describing how the original Cars movie is great because it like introduces this cool new world and it's very Pixar. But then Cars 2 sort of like took everything that was like the comic relief of Cars and then made it an entire movie. And that doesn't make for a good movie. So everybody sort of of knows to not like Cars 2. But then Cars 3 came out and we sort of described it as if it never happened.
Right. That's what we said in episode zero.
In episode zero.
Right.
But someone who listened to the original podcast came back to me and they were like, well, when you were reviewing Cars 3, you said that it was better than Finding Dory. So what does that do to Finding Dory in the scheme of things if you said that Cars 3 basically didn't even happen?
Well, I think when we say it didn't happen, I think it just sort of is easier to forget about in the grand scheme of things.
Sure.
I think I would probably stand by that Cars 3 was better than Finding Dory. Although, I don't know. That doesn't mean neither of them happened. I think in the grand scheme of like the Cars movies, it's like, I don't know. I don't feel like a lot of people go back and continue to talk about Cars 3. But like Cars 1 was great, so there was a lot to talk about. And Cars 2 was so bad, there was a lot to talk about. And Cars 3, still good, just not like, not new. And as a result, you just sort of have this like, yeah, it happened.
It's sort of the bizarre phenomenon of a 3-star review.
You say, I think we gave it better than like a 50 though.
No. And I understand that. But like, I would say that 3-star reviews are generally uncommon.
Yeah, for sure.
Right, because like typically you either love something or you hate it, and so you either love it and give it a 5-star review, or you hate it and give it a 1-star review, or you may have like the circumstances that could lead to it was like really good, but it broke quickly, so you give it 2 stars because it was fine until it didn't work.
Yeah.
Which was too soon. But a 3-star review, it's like, it's such a lukewarm feeling to have about something in general that like most people probably don't have the impetus to go online and be like, oh, yeah, I need a 3-star the review.
That's exactly the thing. It's not like 3-star products and movies don't exist. It's just that 3-star products don't inspire someone to go online and write a review about it. And yeah, it's exactly the Cars phenomenon. We're like, Cars 1, it's so good, you would of course go on and say 5 stars. People should go see this. Cars 2, so bad, you want to make sure like I have things to say. But yeah, Cars 3, it's just like, yeah, it's there and I enjoyed it. But it's not like, it's not rallying you to it. So I agree that there is rarely the 3-star review on almost anything. And let me just preface this, because if you're thinking, hey, I want to go leave a review on this brand new episode 1 of this podcast, please don't leave us a 3-star review. to prove me wrong.
to prove me wrong. Jay briefed me before we talked about this. He was like, I'm going to say this after we talk about 3-star reviews, just to be sure that nobody goes and does that. Which I don't know. Now I'm probably just asking for it.
5-star review, guys.
There we go. Yeah. Thank you guys in advance.
In advance.
But no, okay, so that's sort of like what I sort of wanted to kick off with was this way in which we have opinions, and we actually have someone out there in the world that after every time we review a movie on Super Carlin Brothers, they've gone through and kind of given us like a breakdown of what all of these placements that we've done. And
yeah.
In my mind, looking at this list, they're wildly like out of order at times because we're never consistent on the criteria in which we are like giving a ranking. I don't even think we always use like a scale out of 10. I think sometimes we do it out of 100. So we're sort of teetering. That's an easy conversion to make though. But like the top of our list that we have right now, and this is obviously not super all encompassing, but we would have Black Panther at number 1, Captain Marvel at number 2, and then the live action Beauty and the Beast at number 3.
Okay, so yeah, let me describe for the listeners what I'm looking at here.
Okay, yes.
Because I've often thought after we do a review, like, I don't even know how that stacks up to the other reviews we've done. Like, we don't have a master list anywhere. So you have a screenshot here of the
Of the master list.
Someone has put together the master list. I don't know. Possibly we can put like a link to a Google Docs in like the show notes or something so people can look at this, I think.
Yeah. For sure.
We should do that so people can look here. But it is interesting to me because you're right. We don't really rank them. We do reviews of movies so infrequently that I feel like I've totally forgotten what my bases were for coming up with a score. And we're just sort of doing it on the fly. So yeah, weirdly, if you were to look at this list, it would say that we both like Black Panther a lot.
I stand by that.
I stand by that. That makes sense at number 1. I'm not sure Captain Marvel at number 2. makes a ton of sense.
I think to have Captain Marvel, you know, like decidedly beating out like Coco, for example, or Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yeah.
Spider-Man Far From Home. You know, like there's some like pretty decent, or for example, we have Into the Spider-Verse at the 11th spot.
Yeah.
On this list, which I think is like, that movie is one of, I love that movie.
There are 20 movies on the list for reference. Three of which I don't think we gave a score in the review because it just has question marks.
Hashtag inconsistency for the win.
Hashtag inconsistency. We should really have more of a format for our reviews.
Maybe.
Maybe we should have like categories and like, okay, I can rank it out of this on how it performed. In the, I don't know. But so the really surprising one is Beauty and the Beast, which is number 3 on this list.
Yes.
Behind Black Panther and Captain Marvel.
I want to say Beauty and the Beast was possibly one of the first two movies that we ever reviewed.
I think it was that and maybe like Lego Batman was
the
other one.
Yes. Where did
Lego
Batman
Which is way down on the list. It's like 16.
Right.
So it's interesting. When you look at this list, what do you see that would you change anything?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
So right now, I would say that Into the Spider-Verse, we gave it a collective 8.25 out of 10, which on our very general like rating scale puts it in the number 11 spot. That has to go up, but then above that, especially, we have Fantastic Beasts: The Crimes of Grindelwald currently beating Into the Spider-Verse, which is just a sheer tragedy.
That is
because of course under any circumstances where if you said you want to watch this movie or this movie and you held up both, you know, boxes in front of me,
right,
I would pick Into the Spider-Verse every single time.
Of course This is okay. So that's a great point though, that we have Crimes of Grindelwald, but I will say, what do you think, which review do you think is more accurate than like the one you give right out of the theater or the one that is 6 or 7 months later when you've reflected on the movie for a long time?
Okay, so and this is a question that I want to ask you, is if you have a recency bias, like do you tend to like movies you've seen more recently to the now? Because that, I think, is a weird thing to try to discern. So, like, this year, for example, you know, we're recording this in mid-December. Like, Frozen 2 has been more recent than Toy Story 4.
Right.
Like, how would you stack those two? And do you think the fact that you've seen Frozen 2 more recently than Toy Story 4, and you're currently, like, listening to the soundtrack every day, that maybe you would give Frozen a couple extra ticks that, you know, Toy Story is just being hurt by the fact that it's been so long?
That it's a good, it is interesting. Like, if Frozen 2 came out the summer and Toy Story 4 just came out, would I think Toy Story 4 was the better movie?
Right.
Yeah. According to this list, how do we rank them? We didn't give Toy Story 4 a ranking, but we gave Frozen 2, I give it a 9 out of 10. This says.
This says. Do you stand by that now?
I stand by it. I really liked Frozen 2.
Okay.
I don't know. What would I give Toy? Now I'm like on the spot. What would I give Toy Story 4? Probably not a 9. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think I would give it a 9.
I think it would crack the 9s. Maybe like high 7s, like 7.9 or something.
Okay, so, but like based on this particular rating system, I mean, that would be pretty far down.
I'd probably knock most of these down. I would probably knock my Captain Marvel score down, my Beauty and the Beast score down, I would knock some of these down.
So the other thing that happens to us, I think, and this is something whenever we are reviewing a movie, is that I feel like we tend to be very critical of movies we liked and very complimentary of movies we didn't like. Do you notice that we do this?
That is. So like I remember when we reviewed The Lion King, we went through and I felt like most of the review we spent talking about the stuff we did like because there were so many things not to like.
Sure.
And then we were really nitpicky with other movies that we liked significantly more, like maybe Frozen 2, for example. So that does happen, but I don't know. I don't think you've answered my question.
What was your question?
Was,
sorry.
Which review is more accurate or valuable? The one right after you've seen the movie or after you've had time to reflect?
Okay. I think it's a fair question because it's hard because both things have different values. And I can use Star Wars as like one of the most glaring examples of this for me. So I have always said, like since we have been deep into the world of fandoms, that The Force Awakens is the best in theater experience I've had in the past several years as far as just taking in a movie is concerned.
Right.
Like I sat down and I was absorbed the whole time. Like, at no point in time was I thinking, like, oh, do I need to run to the bathroom? Or, like, I'm almost out of popcorn. Or, like, what am I going to do after this? I was, like, full-blown.
You were there.
In the movie, and I loved it. And to this day, I love The Force Awakens. It's my favorite Star Wars movie. And so that, like, was... that stood the test of time after my theater experience, which I do rank very highly. And to this day, I still like it. But then there are other situations where, like, my theater experience is good, but then the further that I get from it, the more I'm like, oh no, that is not good at all. And the good example of that would be The Crimes of Grindelwald.
For sure.
And I think that there was something happening there where you and I both consider Fantastic Beasts to be the best of the Harry Potter movies.
I think I would probably stand by that. Yeah, I really like the first Fantastic Beasts movie quite a bit.
And
I know a lot of people would say that's not really a Harry Potter movie. And when people, I feel like I like giving that answer because I know it's a bit of a shock answer.
Sure.
When I know what people are really asking is which of the first eight actual Harry Potter movies do you like? And I'm like, haha, trick.
Trick question.
Yeah.
Either way, we had a whole lot of speculation that could happen. There was a lot of mystery that was being introduced. There's a lot to be said with the fact that we were going to get introduced to Dumbledore, you know, properly in The Crimes of Grindelwald. And we spent like an entire year breaking apart every single trailer. And there was like, it was so rich for content for us. Like we were able to, you know, just like find all these nitty gritty details hidden everywhere. And we're like looking at Google Maps, trying to find the specific locations in Paris and like dissecting all these French words. And I mean, we were doing all sorts of stuff, and it was so much fun. And then Warner Brothers reaches out and they're like, do you guys want an early screening of the movie? And we were like, duh, you know. So like, we had spent the whole year enjoying this movie.
Oh yeah.
And then I think what happened was we got in there and you and I like were so ridiculously well informed on like the Lestrange family tree and all these weird like inner workings that are happening inside of the movie and like all the background stuff that's going on, whereas if we just like walked in blind and sat down and be like, what is happening right now? Who is that person? Why are they important? Did she just die? Who does she love?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but like we were like really well versed on it. And so I think you and I walked out of the theater being like, whoa, mind blown, that was amazing. Like, and we were trusting the writing that like when we went back and like looked at all these details that we needed to find, that the answers were going to have been there the whole time.
Right. I think that was the thing, because that is so often the case with Harry Potter, where right. like, oh, the like when you reread it again, so many things pop out and you're like, oh man, no, well, yes, of course,
like that makes so much more sense
that
now.
Makes so much
like
more sense.
It was set up so far in advance.
The other thing about The Crimes of Grindelwald in particular is we did get to go to a somewhat early screening, but we also had the really cool opportunity to visit New York City. We got invited by Warner Brothers there to go see an early screening of one of the trailers and to like see the Cursed Child. We got to we got to be in a picture with J.K. Rowling and like 100 other people.
Yes.
That was an amazing thing. Maybe we should talk about that in a second. But then we also got to meet like a lot of the cast of the movie. Like, this was a unique buildup to a more unique buildup to any movie I've ever seen ever. Plus, we correctly called the Nagini reveal.
Yes.
And that was like a big, whoa, that was a big win for the Super Carlin Brothers just channel.
Right. Like, we made t-shirts about it.
Made t-shirts about it. That was fun. So you're right. You said something just now that really kind of stuck out. I mean, like, we enjoyed this movie all year.
Yes.
Which is sort of, I wonder if that's more of a thing these days, like where the movie itself almost isn't even what you're enjoying.
It's the anticipation.
As much as the anticipation. We were like looking, it was really fun looking forward to The Crimes of Grindelwald all year. And then it has a bad reputation for falling really flat now.
Yes, of course. That's a very classic, you know, the destination is the journey. Mm-hmm. Do I get that right? The journey is the destination.
Yeah.
One way or another. That'll make sense. But like, you know, so like right now, for example, I'm planning my wedding in January. And so for the past several months, like, I have been enjoying my wedding mm-hmm. every single day. And like, I have made it a specific point to embrace the fact that I'm probably enjoying it more now than I'm going to be able to actively do it the day of the wedding when everything is this like insane whirlwind.
Oh, I really doubt that.
Really?
Oh, I think you're going to
blast be
great? At your wedding. Yeah.
Amazing.
Well, I mean, your wedding day is a day that is just all about you and from like top to bottom. And as long as your brother doesn't like forget to pick you up in the morning,
hey,
you feel like
hey.
Someone like you're being paid attention to all day.
Dude, can we tell that story? Yeah, let's do it. So I was Jay's best man in his wedding, And the night before, we're doing the rehearsal dinner, and the whole family, like, that's the thing, is that weddings are really family reunions.
Basically.
So you get to see all these people in a context that you don't normally get to see them. Like, it's not Christmas for once, you know? Like, everything right. is different. And so as we are, like, going out after the rehearsal dinner, we're all at, like, this bar, and the whole family's there, and we're all just, like, you know, cheers in and having, like, a really good time and all that. I had maybe, like, one too many Cherry Cokes, and we're having a conversation before the evening's end where we're supposed to meet at a barbershop the next morning to get ready, and you're like, you're giving me a ride in the morning, and I'm like, I'm giving you a ride in the morning. And the next morning, I show up at the barbershop, and I'm like, why is Jay not here? Like, what is going on?
Bad day to oversleep.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Like, seriously, dude, it's your wedding.
Yeah.
And so I call him. I'm like, dude, where are you? And he's like, you're supposed to pick me up. And I'm like,
oh no. Everything comes flooding back.
Oh my gosh. The color just drained from my face again. Just reliving the moment. It's like, no.
It was really funny because, yeah, I think you called me and your exact words were, where are you? And my words to you are, where are you?
I know. And then I'm like, but of course, I'm standing there with all the other groomsmen. So I'm like, I know I'm in the right place. What is he talking about? Like, yeah. Where am I? I'm in the right place.
I am where you told us to be. Yeah, I remember getting there, and the other part was that we, like, when you, we had arranged, to meet at a barbershop, everyone's gonna get, like, you know, a touch-up on, like, their haircuts and
beards and stuff.
But the place you go to that we did it, they also offered, like, a whole, like, breakfast package where they would bring, like, fruit and bagels and cream cheese and stuff, and, like, you know, we'd gone ahead and done that, because this was gonna be, like, breakfast for everyone, too.
Right, right.
So I get there, and everything's gone.
Oh no, I don't even think I realized that. Oh, this is terrible. So, yeah. My guilt is so much worse.
I don't really ever think about it, but it is fun to hold against you sometimes.
Nice, nice. Thank you for that. Yeah. Thank you for that. My my guilt is real.
Anytime. Anytime. Let me ask you this. Is there anything on your wedding that you are doing to prepare your appearance that is above, that is beyond your regular getting ready?
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes. I'm getting a spray tan.
Oh.
A spray tan. Wow. Yes. So there was a night, we're getting married at Disney, and so we were going down to do our planning session in October, and before we went, like, we knew we were going to be on camera and stuff while we were down there. So Allie was like, well, I'm going to get a spray tan before we go. And so, like, we pull up at the place the night before, like, we're getting on the plane to go down and everything, and she's like, why don't you just come in? Your first one's free anyway, so, like, you can just do it. And I was like, all right. Like, I'll go in. And boy, howdy, did I feel confident that whole week. I was like, I'm glowing. I'm glowing. Like, it was the most unusual experience I ever had for something that I mean, Allie gets them all the time, so it's, I'm not, like, you know, unaware of the effect, but I think that she so regularly has them that it's just sort of part of, like, what her appearance is to me.
Right.
So when she comes home, I'm not like, oh, there we go. That's the way I like ya. something weird like that. So no, it was odd, but so the whole, actually, I guess, are you doing it as well? I think
full disclosure, Ben, I guess, has asked if everyone, all the groomsmen, wanted to go do this as, like, a group bonding experience, and everyone was pretty much in. So yeah, I will also be getting my first spray tan ever.
Oh, you're gonna love it.
I hope so. I'm afraid, I think whenever you tell someone about a spray tan, they'll always bring up the episode of Friends where Ross does it wrong.
Yes. He's like, I'm an eight. Classic.
Oh man. So yeah, hopefully that doesn't happen.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, that's, fingers crossed. Hopefully it all works out. And we don't look strange, but it's going to be an interesting experience. And I think this is the first time I'm telling you this bit of information. Because we're doing it at, like, Disney, they come in and they do it, like, manually.
Oh really?
So, like, there's a person who does it.
So we're gonna have, like, a really, like, fancy
A fancy spray tan. Yeah, like, you're not going and standing in a booth. You're going to go stand in front of a person.
Even better.
And these are, like, the people who do, like celebrities and stuff for events, because it is Disney. Like, right. So that's, like, the group that comes and does it. So, like, Allie's been looking at their Instagram, and she keeps, like, alerting me, like, all these, like, famous people who have gotten spray tans from the same people as us. So when you guys see pictures of us, be sure to notice that perfect glint. That
perfect glow.
Yes. Yeah.
Hopefully.
Anyway, should we talk about movies?
We could talk about movies. What do you want to talk about?
Okay. So Because I don't even know how far our tangent went from where we were once upon a time. I think we were talking about the recency of watching a movie to whether or not you like it more or less.
Okay, well, that is what we were talking about. Although I noticed you have another thing in our little notes here.
Okay, yes.
And I think we need to address it.
Okay, talk to me.
So, as we're recording this, we have not seen Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker yet.
We have not.
So, bear that in mind as we enter into this discussion about Star Wars movies.
Star Wars movies, yep.
Okay.
So we still don't know. As you're listening to this, you probably know what happened. We, as people existing speaking into microphones right now, do not know.
We do not know.
Yes.
But it's not particularly relevant to the conversation.
Unless,
just want to let people know.
Unless it is.
Unless you think?
Which what? I think is a point we can bring up. But.
Okay. So anyway, I'm sure you can check out if you want to hear what our thoughts on The Rise of Skywalker are, our review's already out there.
Yes.
On the main YouTube channel. But as we're recording it, we haven't seen it. In the meantime, though, Ben has discovered a really interesting phenomenon on just Rotten Tomatoes with the rest of the Star Wars movies.
Yes.
So the original trilogy, 4, 5, 6, is highly beloved by almost everyone. The prequel trilogy is largely considered to be a little bit worse.
Yes.
And the sequel trilogy coming out now is sort of take it or leave it for some people.
It's a strange phenomenon, yeah. Yes. And what I went through and basically did was under all of these, it's uncommon for the relationship between the audience score on Rotten Tomatoes and the critic score on Rotten Tomatoes to be exactly the same.
Right. That's almost never the case.
It's almost never the case, right? So I have like my deviation scored out here on each of the movies to sort of determine how far from the critic score the audience score ultimately was.
Right.
Because in general, I think that all of us standard folk qualify as the audience score, not as the critic score.
I feel like you and I land somewhere in the middle.
Somewhere, okay, sure, you know? Sure.
We do movie reviews. Like.
That's true.
Yeah.
But that's one of those weird things where I've thought about this before. Our reviews probably ultimately have more viewership than that of most other movie reviewers.
Oh, I agree with that. Like,
but like our voice is like irrelevant.
Well, because like, yeah, we put it up on YouTube and we get a good number of views on most of our reviews. But if you like, you know, a lot of people who are leaving reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, like they're probably not getting enough people aren't probably reading their review.
They're reading the score.
They're reading the score.
People look at the score.
Yeah. I mean, you can go in and read the individual reviews, but even then, I'll just normally read like the 2-sentence blip.
Right.
Which you can normally click on to get a full article written by these people.
Sure.
Yeah. But anyway, so what Ben did was went through and just figured out the difference in score between audience and critic for every Star Wars movie. And there's like just one giant outlier.
There is. It sticks out like a sore thumb. And I'm sure anybody listening who has any idea about Star Wars knows exactly where we're going with this.
So the difference, the highest, so like for example, the audience score on The Phantom Menace is 59. The critic score is 54. So the difference is only 5.
Right. Yeah. So it's like both critics and audience agree it's a pretty middle of the road movie. Like it's only okay. And actually, before we go any further, there is a question that I wanted to ask you about the way that these scores align. Like, to what extent do you think that if critics are doing their job well, should their collective aggregate score be a representation of what the audience score should be?
Oh, I don't think that's...
Okay, but so the reason you say that, though, probably is because I'm sure that you know that when it comes to producing a movie, there is a difference between the movie that the lay viewer might enjoy and what is also a very well-made movie. Is that correct? Like, would you say that critics are assessing the quality of the movie on the story, the filming, the photography, the videography, like all the elements
all
that come
into
it?
All the elements of producing a film.
Producing a film.
Yeah.
But it also has to have a story that logically makes sense.
Right.
Like, critics are still assessing that.
Yeah.
But critics may not take into account whether or not a movie is entertaining. Is that?
I mean, they may or may not.
They may or may not. Okay.
I think the audience score tends to come from whether or not a movie made sense, or like whether or not a movie was entertaining, though.
Sure. Okay. Yes. Okay.
Yes. Or, well, yeah. Yes. That's what I'm going to go with.
Okay.
But anyway, getting back to our lovely chart here. So the difference, like we said, between The Phantom Menace, 59-54, that's just a difference of 5. Now, the difference between any Star Wars movie, the audience and the critic score, the greatest it gets for all but one is 14 points.
Right,
and
which
is Revenge of the Sith, where the audience said it was a 66, the critics said it was an 80.
Which I would say that I think that Revenge of the Sith is the best of the prequels.
I think that is what I would agree with as well. And that is what it would appear to be is the general consensus based on Rotten Tomatoes.
Sure.
However, the actual greatest one, the actual greatest difference between audience and critic score is a whopping 47 points, total outlier on The Last Jedi, where the audience gives it a 44% and the critics give it a 91%.
Certified fresh.
Certified fresh.
Yes.
So what do you make of this?
This phenomenon has baffled me for a long time. And it's like, what's weird about it is that a lot of the people that I go to and like trust their opinions about things love this movie.
Right.
And it seems like the general public, beyond people who are like tuned into like critiquing movies, don't. and I know that like when we saw what was our rating, like so our knee jerk
reaction.
So I gave it an 8.2 and you gave it an 8.7.
Right.
Do you stand by that review?
Let's see. Did we review The Force Awakens as well?
I don't think we did.
Here? No.
Yeah.
Okay. That's surprising.
Yeah. The Force Awakens is arguably my favorite movie. So for me,
I know what happened is that I had a child. That's what happened then, right? Is that was then?
That might have been.
No. I don't know.
Okay.
Well, whatever. We didn't review The Force Awakens. I enjoyed that a lot more than The Last Jedi. What was your question?
Do you stand by your review of an 8.7?
I'd probably go a little bit lower.
Okay.
At this point. I've been in a very Star Wars mood lately, and we have been watching sections of The Last Jedi, and there are parts of it I do really, really like.
Yes.
But there are other parts where I'm just like, it feels unwatchable.
Okay. And so basically the best possible explanation that I have been able to come to for The Last Jedi, I mean, is written right here on the walls, is that like when you're a critic and you're going into reviewing a movie, you're not focusing on how well that movie fits into the known universe of every other movie that like relates to it. You're
right.
Treating it as an individual installment, as a movie. How does it perform start to finish? Does it tell a story? Is it compelling? Mm-hmm. All of that. Like, so critics are not holding it to the bigger story, and they don't even have to be Star Wars fans. Like,
right.
And I think what you get with this is sort of the same phenomenon that you see very frequently with like movies that win Academy Awards, where you have movies that are very, very well made. They're very like artistic. They have an incredibly like incredibly deep meaning built into every part of the story, top to bottom. But very frequently, you haven't seen all of the movies that are nominated for Best Picture because they are not necessarily by design the most entertaining movies on the market, or they don't have the kind of budgets for marketing, or they're not blockbuster hits.
Right.
You know, like it's a different kind of movie altogether.
Yeah.
And so for me with The Last Jedi, on some level, I think you get this unusual phenomenon where it is an incredibly well-made movie. The cinematography behind it is, I would say, unparalleled. Like, you know, the scenes on the salt planet where you've got the speeders going across and
right.
the red dust king. I mean, that's like, it's gorgeous. It's really cool. It's very like interesting and thought out. But then you've got all of everyone else who sees the movies and who saw the movie that are Star Wars fans.
Right.
And I think that is where this movie, like it deviated in so many different directions from what Star Wars fans might have expected, especially from like what was teed up with The Force Awakens and just how all of the different characters were handled. And I think that made it so that everybody who was really leaned into this world was like, no.
Yeah, right. It's like, what I think is interesting is that Star Wars in general has become like its own genre of movie.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
Like it falls under the world of sci-fi, but you can put it broadly in there, but like a Star Wars movie has a particular Star Warsiness about it.
Yes.
It's not just a sci-fi. It's like it is its own kind of movie at
right.
this point. It has such a defined style. Like The Mandalorian is coming out right now, and it feels like the most Star Wars thing I've seen in a long time.
Right. Well, I mean, it's, you know, it becomes the space western you sort of think of as Star Wars. And it's like, I think that's where the prequels deviated so far from what we love about gunslinging, laser sword wielding characters, right, who are fun and exciting and funny. You know, and they made it all about like these weird trade federation laws and, right, you know, like I can't even tell you what the main conflict of the prequels are, and we're literally, you know, self-proclaimed experts on the topic. You know, it becomes like this weird thing. But then The Mandalorian goes back to these roots of like each episode in my mind, like as I'm like watching it unfold, it's like on this episode of The Mandalorian.
Yeah.
The Mandalorian and his new companion who we'll never see again go into the woods to fight a thing.
Ooh, here's a fun theory for you.
Okay, lay it
on me. Mandalorian wise, what if the title The Mandalorian is referring to the child?
Oh.
You know what I mean? Wouldn't that be crazy?
That would be crazy because it would be so very unexpected for the Mandalorian to be not this character that you imagine as Boba Fett, effectively.
The Mandalorian's not the character wearing the Mandalorian armor, embodying the Mandalorian lifestyle.
Right. And I think what it means to be a Mandalorian is absolutely going to be something that is peeled back and revealed in a way that is not maybe what you'd expect. Like, I think there's no two ways about it. The main character that we know as Mando was not born a Mandalorian.
I think as of maybe the last episode, which as we're recording was episode 5, they've pretty much confirmed that. I think it's like a one-liner sort of thing where he says he was like adopted by them and,
right,
yeah.
Yes.
And as such, so what does it mean? Does it mean you were born there or that you embody everything they stand for?
Right,
sort
right
of thing. But then if little baby Yoda was actually born there and he isn't, like, in a way a Mandalorian, even though he's not humanoid, it'd be pretty cool.
That'd be pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Heard it here first, folks.
There you go. But yeah, so, okay, so you go back to The Last Jedi. And the thing that I've always come back to with this is that at times I have felt like I am not smart enough to enjoy The Last Jedi.
Mm.
Like, that is, like, the only thing that I've been able to sort of, like, dissect out of everything, because there are such, like, deep themes,
yeah,
in the movie that, like, a lot of times, like, we have this guy, Scott, here at the office with us, who is, like, he's so good at dissecting movies, and he, like, understands them innately on a level that I feel like I don't.
Right.
And, like, you and I will, like, be having a conversation about something, and he'll, like, come poke his head in through the door and be like, it's because of this. And it's always like, oh, well, that is a good point, now that you say it that way. Specifically speaking to the idea of, in The Last Jedi, there's this moment where Luke returns, and he's standing out, like, you know, on the salt field,
right,
and Kylo Ren comes down, and they're going toe-to-toe, and, you know, like, Luke opens up his lightsaber, and he's literally using the lightsaber that, like, moments before this scene, Kylo Ren himself
destroyed
yeah, in like, this force pull battle with,
right,
Rey.
So if you're paying attention, you should know how to get that lightsaber.
Right. And, you know, like, and Scott's assessment of this situation is that, like, what they're saying is that, you know, Kylo doesn't learn from his mistakes. Like,
right, he doesn't learn from the past.
And it's like, when you say that, it's like, oh, then it doesn't feel like a mistake that they use that lightsaber instead of the green lightsaber that we know that Luke is supposed to be using at this point in time, and that Ben would know him to use at this point in time.
Right.
And so there's like this part of me that, like, inherently will understand, like, oh, that is a good point. Like, that's an interesting take on this particular problem, where, like, I may have seen it as an issue, but you actually saw it as, like, a part of creative storytelling if you, like, really peek into the layers of the story.
Right.
To me, there comes a question, though, of, and this goes back to, like, my 11th grade English class, where, you know, you're reading through all of this, like, literature through the ages and stuff like that, and the teacher is insisting that, you know, the guy's green vest is supposed to be symbolic of that character's greed, and I'm like, or because it's a green vest, maybe it's just a green vest, maybe that's what the author wanted to do. And, like, me as a writer, it's like, I don't know that I personally would think myself smart enough to think that every detail that I included was inherently part of the character's, like, overall intentions and motives. And because I don't think that way, I'm like, well, there's no way the author thinks that way.
Right. Like, you can't put yourself in those shoes. And there's, you know, so, you know, every book is different. And,
right,
you know, a lot of the things you read in high school, you're reading because the author had lots of intent.
Yes.
But I think that's not a discernment most high schoolers arrive at.
Yes.
Because it's just some... just another book you're being forced to read.
Right. And you're not studying it. And that's what's been strange to me, I think, as like, I hated research papers and I never understood what the purpose of them was when I was in high school and stuff. And now as we are like, you know, YouTube theorists, we write research papers every day. Like that's what we do for a job.
Quite a bit.
And I think that the difference in approach has completely changed the way that like I view details and things, which brings me, you know, like what I feel like is a now more enlightened and, you know, richer person in the world of the way that I consume media. Like I should be the type of person who that detail's not lost on me. It's like, oh, it's the blue lightsaber. That's the dead giveaway right there. Like that's, he's not learning from this past, but that's not what happens to me.
Right.
When I'm watching this movie at full speed, it's like, yes, that is ultimately true. And if you have somebody who is like doing a study on The Last Jedi, then that becomes like an interesting detail to pull apart and ask as a quiz question, you know, about the movie and all of its themes.
Right.
But is that something that when you're watching the movie at full speed on its first pass that you're supposed to like inherently take from
like
it right
absorb.
Away. Yes. And that's where I don't know if there's a bit of a difference here in the quote unquote reading level of this movie. Like, and that's why I say like, I'm not sure that I'm like smart enough
right.
to understand it.
Yeah.
Is that like, I don't know if what happens is that to the best of my ability, despite the fact that I have a reasonable working knowledge of the known Star Wars universe, details like that were ultimately lost on me.
Right. Like if you are, yeah, like a critic and like, really paying attention to the visual storytelling and you go back and like really study it, I'm sure you will find that The Last Jedi is done really, really well and that much of the visual storytelling in and of itself drives home the themes of the movie.
Yes.
Yes. Which is great. But then like, I think what bothers stuff, it's like, and that's great. And maybe that does make it in some ways a good movie. But in other ways, Rose should not have stopped Finn from crashing into the thing. And it's like, I can't get over stuff like that, you know?
There are details about it. And you're absolutely right. Like there are multiple moments. There are at least two deaths that should have happened that they undid in this movie. And I think the first one is Leia, you know, like where when I'm watching the movie and again at full speed, which is what I mean by like, you know, sitting in the audience first pass at it, and the Leia, like Ben is flying in there and he decides not to shoot the cockpit, like where he
right.
knows his mom to be standing.
Yeah.
But then one of his, you know, fellow TIE fighters does.
Yeah.
To me, at full speed, my thinking is like, oh my God, the two people that he could have killed that would have taken him all the way to the dark side are Han Solo and Leia. And both of them died. But I would have made the argument at that point in time, like within that split second moment where you thought she was completely dead, that Han did in fact pull the lightsaber trigger. Like he decided to let Kylo Ren kill him or to kill himself to remove the possibility of Ben being
right.
able to do that. Like
right.
it's like now you can't. Now
right.
you cannot kill me, which is like one act of evil that you can't do
yeah.
to turn you all over to the dark side. Same thing with this, is you have this moment where it's like he's flying in, he's got his finger on the trigger, and he doesn't do it. And
right.
then someone else does, and it's
and
like
now he can't.
The outcome is the same, exactly. And it's
right.
like, and that's amazing to me. It's like, oh my God, like as evil as they can make him, they can never give him the opportunity to do the ultimate thing that would absolutely tip him over to the dark side.
Right.
And then Leia floats through space.
And then, yeah, then she's not dead.
And to me, this is a double whammy because for one, this amazing revelation that's just washed over me. I'm like, that was the boldest thing you ever could have done. You killed Leia in like one fell swoop. It wasn't even like, you know, this insane built up, like,
right.
you know, whoa, it happened like in the speed of battle. But then also, so they have her float through space, which is this like it's not even that that's something that the Force might be capable of doing. It's that they're in the vacuum of space.
Right. Like instant death.
Instant death. Like
yeah.
you freeze to death the moment you are exploded out there. Not to mention the fact that you were in a cockpit that was just blown up.
Right.
You know, so it's like the force, the thrust, the, you know, all of the things involved, like in my mind, in every single way, shape and form, just lead to sudden death. And I suppose you can make the argument that the Force keeps her alive, but it was a really unusual, quirky way to demonstrate for the first time ever, really, Leia using Force powers in any capacity.
Well, I remember watching that scene for the first time too, and my initial thought, because it happens really early in the movie, was that like I was like impressed with the boldness of the decision
yes.
to kill Leia. Just boom, just like that. And I was like, without even, and like, I was like, At first I was like, man, I can't believe they didn't give you like a moment to say goodbye because the scene finishes. But then they cut back to her and I was like, here we go. Here's the sad. Oh my gosh. She's flying. She's flying. Whoops. Okay, she's not dead.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so there was, I mean, whether or not you like Space Leia, it sounds to me like what you and I value when we're reviewing movies is much more like the bold storytelling.
Sure.
Rather than like bold story theming.
Maybe. And you know, like, again, I go back to sort of like, maybe that's just our Neanderthal brains being like, ooh, give us a shiny, cool thing that we don't expect.
Well, maybe. But like, there's certainly, I think like it comes down to whether or not you think the point of making a film is the way you make a film.
Sure.
Or, you know, like, and I think to some people, and I think a lot of critics, because a lot of them are in the filmmaking industry,
right,
that's really important to them. And that's, and fair enough, because it's how you push the envelope is, you know, trying new methods and new stuff. But like at the end of the day, the story itself still has to make sense.
It does. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, okay. And so then with that, there's, I guess, a couple other points that you could get to. So like you brought up already sort of the idea that, you know, Finn at the end is basically laying it all out there. Every other speeder is pulled away and he's like, I'm doing it. I have to do this.
Yes.
Like, I am fully committed to the cause. I'm going to sacrifice myself to save the day. Like, gonna go for it. And then at the last second, somehow, some way, Rose's speeder was fast enough to, despite the fact having pulled off, has now been able to come in at a curve and hit him sideways.
Yeah. Even though he had a head start and was going at full speed and she peeled off, she got ahead of him and could crash him. Whatever.
Right, right. Which the logistics alone seemed like a little bit iffy at best. But so then, like, what happens after that moment that you feel like it was, or what argument would the movie make where it was essential that Finn not sacrifice himself there?
I don't know, because all Rose says is like, that's what you do for someone you love. That, like, sort of, it's like a love conquers all sort of moment.
Right.
The problem is, one, is that, as we just described, the logistics of how she crashes him doesn't even make sense. Two, that the very act of crashing him might have killed him anyway.
Right.
And three, saving him from doing this exact thing just allows the First Order to kill you anyway.
Right.
Because that's what's gonna happen.
Right.
Like, you're not really saving him.
Yes.
Like, you're both gonna die in just another 5 minutes, if not seconds. You know,
because they don't know Luke is about to show up as a unprecedented force vision.
Exactly.
Right.
Like, they don't know that's about to happen. You know, all she does is save him from saving everyone, but she only saves him for like another minute.
Right.
You know, and everyone's gonna die.
Right.
So it's, to me, it's like, not only could she not have circled around, she could have killed him in the process, but three, her saving him just mostly does nothing anyway.
Right.
Barring Luke showing up. Which,
yes.
There's no way she could have known.
Right.
You
right.
know?
Yes.
So I hate that moment for so many reasons. And
it's complicated.
Yeah.
So, okay. So at the beginning of the episode, I said to you, that you made the comment that most of what we're going to talk about today probably doesn't matter based on what happens in The Rise of Skywalker. What happens to you if a lot of things you didn't understand about The Last Jedi are very neatly resolved in the Rise of Skywalker? Like, what does that do for, like, our kids someday who don't have to wait to watch the next episode?
Right, like, if... Well, I don't know. I mean, I think I'm okay with going back and being like, oh, you know what? Having seen how it ends, The Last Jedi, favorite Star Wars.
Sure,
you
okay.
Know?
So you'd be willing to come around to that?
If you want to be right all the time, you have to be willing to change your mind all the time.
There you go.
There you go.
J. Carlin ruled the life.
There you go. And, you know, you can only be as right as the information you have presently.
Right.
And if you get new information and all of a sudden it turns out you were wrong, then sticking to your guns is pretty stupid at that point.
Sure.
Because it's obvious you're wrong now.
Right. Yeah. Because that becomes the question to me, though, because I think it's interesting. It's not even a sticking to your guns type of thing. It's with the limited amount of information that you had when you viewed The Last Jedi, like, it's interesting to me that it could become the best movie when all you had was it, it couldn't be. Mm. Like, because to me, I feel like that almost speaks to this idea of what everything does as an entire narrative, mm-hmm. so to speak. So it's sort of like everything makes sense once you see the whole picture, and it's like, oh, okay. Because then maybe you do go back to it, and knowing what you know, it's sort of like, okay. Yeah. Like, well, that's all coming together.
I'll give an example here of, I was trying to think, has this ever happened to me? Are there episodes of stuff that when I watched them the first time, I was like, God, okay, whatever. Uh-huh. But then in the fullness of time, once the ending has been resolved and you go back and rewatch it, like, suddenly certain episodes stand out.
Yes.
Like, is a lot better. And so I know you haven't watched The Last Airbender, but I think I can still make this example work. There's, I don't want to, like, spoil it all for you.
Go ahead, it's okay.
Okay, yeah. Okay. You can probably tell where it's going anyway. Spoilers for The Last Airbender, the show, coming up, FYI. Are you familiar with Prince Zuko, the guy hunting down the Avatar?
Yes.
Right, so over the course of the show, he slowly is eventually the Avatar's firebending teacher.
Okay.
Like, he eventually comes around full circle, is the good guy.
Yes.
And whatever. So there's an episode, I think, in season 2 where it's just called, I think it's called Zuko Alone. And the whole episode is him just sort of traveling around, like, roaming as this, like, lost warrior. And, like, nothing happens in the plot. You just learn a lot about Zuko.
Okay.
And a lot about his past and, like, his sister and, like, why he is the way he is or how he was different as a kid. And it's just, like, I remember watching that and being like, all right, I guess that was okay. Like, you know, it wasn't like a real exciting episode with like a lot of fights or like nothing really progressed with Aang and company, you know, nothing new happened. It was just a straight up character episode.
Okay.
But at that point, when you go back and you see where Zuko started and where you see where he ends, then when you watch this episode, knowing his full story, it really is a lot more impactful. And it's like, he's like one of the best characters on the show all of a sudden.
Okay.
And he's like so important. And like, it's much more interesting to know, like, okay, I like this episode a lot more now that I know the end.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So, okay, then if we're to bring it full, like, not full tilt, but if we bring it back to Star Wars, then how do you feel about Solo, where you have a movie that's entirely dedicated to a character that you ultimately know you love?
I've only seen Solo once. And it was in theaters.
You've only seen it one time.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I watched it last night.
Did you really?
I did.
I will say, actually, I tried to watch it a few nights ago, and it's not on Disney Plus.
It is not.
I do own the movie, so I still could have watched it, but I was already in the app, and Rogue One was right there, and we were also talking about that, so I watched that instead.
Okay, sure.
Because it had been a while. I will say Rogue One, I thought, aged a lot better. There's still things I have issues with. And there are many things that... it's going to be hard for me to talk about Solo, because I've only seen it the one time.
So let me just go ahead and jump you to sort of the point of the reason why I asked that specific question is because I feel like in general, I actually quite liked Solo. I don't know that I'm winning many fans with that opinion, but you tended to not like it as much.
I felt like there was just little things that just made Han Solo a lot less cool.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is like, it was like the Han shot first thing, but they just doubled down on a lot of the things.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I don't like how they came up with his last name. Just like, no, his last name was cool, man. It's just like some random dude just decided.
Some guy who's like scoffing at him.
Yeah, some guy's just like, it's Solo. And he's like, all right, cool.
It seemed, honestly, I felt like it was giving a little bit too much credit to the guy who is standing there working at the admissions office for the Imperial Army.
Yeah.
Where it's like, that's a somewhat creative name to just like pop off instead of like Smith.
Well, it's like, I think I ever really thought Solo was like his given last name. It just always felt like a chosen name.
Okay.
Like, my name is Han Solo. And like, it sounds like he seems like the arrogant, cool guy who literally chose his own name and made it Solo.
Right. You know, so he's like Flynn Rider.
Like, my headcanon was that he chose it and it was like, yeah, it's like Flynn Rider. Exactly. Like, this is just cool. Or maybe he knew of a different Solo or something and he adopted it or something like that. But that would have been fine. But to just get it at complete random because he was by himself checking into the Imperial Army. Ugh, so dumb. Anyway. I don't like the way they drum up the dice so much, which is a way for like The Last Jedi to retroactively add
more
meaning to the scene where Luke hands Leia the dice. And it's like, when that movie came out, those dice meant nothing.
There's no two ways about it. That's definitely true. They were trying to make the dice more important in the fullness of time. Again, to the idea of, let's say, you know, 20 years from now, our kids are watching them from episode 1 all the way through and, you know, chronologically. Mm-hmm. Then by the time the dice resurface, you might be kind of like, hasn't it been a while since we really saw those dice? Like
if you watched Solo first and then you went through and watched everything, like, yeah, if you watched it in chronological order, not in release date order or whatever, you would probably be like, oh, the dice from yeah, it's like the first shot in Solo. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it might be a cool thing, but I don't know. I don't like the dice, especially because they're not dice you can actually roll.
Sure.
You know, they're on a chain.
So. Right. Yes. There's that.
Whatever.
Okay. So anyway, I guess what it comes down to, and the point of this episode to me, was sort of to speak to this idea that we have strong opinions that are always subject to morphing.
Yeah.
As time goes on, and as we have more exposure to the media, and we have more opportunity to continue to do what we do, which is to meticulously dissect every detail and make sure that it holds up.
That's what we're going to keep doing. Yeah. I will say, one of the fun things we did after the zero episode of the podcast, of the pop, was we created a channel in our Discord server called Strong Opinions.
Yes.
Where people could just, the one rule pinned at the top is like, you can only have really strong opinions about things that don't matter.
Yes.
In this thing. And oh my gosh, it was so funny to see the things.
Do you have any specific examples of things that people have strong opinions about?
There was
about?
A lot of, like, you know, Pop-Tarts or ravioli and that kind of stuff flying around.
Sure.
Now I wish I did have a better example off the top of my head. I would encourage you though to go check it out. It's a fun, if you have a fun opinion about something that you want to share.
Yeah, it's a way that if you are already involved with the Super Carlin Brothers community as it stands, there is sort of an opportunity to go in there and have a place to talk about, you know, the pop. As we're calling it. Yeah, it's totally catching on. So that's going to be the Strong Opinions tab in the Discord, which you can get to if you're not already by going to patreon.com/supercarlinbrothers. The $3 tier is our Discord server where you get access to all of that information and lots of other cool stuff. Otherwise, we also have a Facebook page set up where we're going to hopefully have some amount of conversation happening with...
This is the first time there's no comment section on podcasts. So.
Right.
Like, where are people going to talk about it? And so the Discord is a great place, but you do have to pay to get to Discord. And I feel like we need a completely free space for people to discuss it. So we do have
a Facebook page that I highly encourage you to go and check out. It is just called Popcorn Culture. If you search it, you'll see our logo there. So far, we're pretty lacking in our activity, but hopefully that will change drastically. So if you have any thoughts about our first three episodes, all of which are available today, happy Christmas again. Be sure to go and leave all of your thoughts there so we can have some feedback and some information to fuel further episodes.
Yes, let us know how much you disagree with us about everything with your strong opinions about weak things.
Yes, exactly. Otherwise, I think that is all for episode one.
Wow.
Did we do it?
We did it.
Oh my gosh. Should we stop recording now? Do we keep talking?
I think we're done.
Bye.
Pop.